Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torlap. Today, Arlene Bloom and Pam Miller with Alaska Community Action on Toxics join me to discuss Arlene's contributions to mountaineering and science. Arlene helped organize and lead the first all-women climbs of Denali and Annapurna, and was the first American woman to attempt Everest. While breaking stereotypes in the mountaineering world, she did the same as a scientist. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Yes, thank you very much, Paul.
Arlene and Pam, I'm just thrilled to have you both here. Arlene's up in Alaska on a little tour. Sounds like you're getting some skiing in and doing some talks about your work. So Arlene, let's start with you. Tell us about yourself, in particular your climbing and your mountaineering history, and sort of maybe a little bit about how you got into that. How did you become a mountaineer?
Well, I went to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and actually there was a really cute guy sitting next to me in chemistry. Yeah. And we studied chemistry till late one starry night, and he said, "Do you want to climb Mount Hood?" And he was very handsome, so I said, "Sure." And so we drove to Timberline Lodge, and he put an old army surplus backpack on me, and I was from Chicago. I'd never done anything physical, and he later said I was gasping so loudly he didn't think I'd make it out of the parking lot, but he was very handsome, and I was determined. And so I followed him, and we'd started at 3 a.m, but the sun rose, and it was the most beautiful place I'd ever been, you know, a wonderland of crevasses and green and blue ice, the glacier. And so I fell in love with him and with mountain climbing and with chemistry.
So was the guy related to the chemistry too?
My chemistry lab partner. Randomly, he was from Portland, Oregon, so he was a Portland Mazama climber.
Yeah.
So I continued doing climbs with my friends from Reed College, and for my senior thesis at Reed, I collected fumarole gases from the crater of Mount Hood, so that gave me a chance to do chemistry and climbing together.
Oh, fun.
And in fact, it was really interesting. In 1936, somebody got too near the fumaroles. You know, that's where they have sulfur near the top of Mount Hood, and actually died. And the Portland Fire Department went to rescue them, and they couldn't because of all the gases.
So
they dealt with it, and they had a Reed senior do a thesis analyzing the gas composition. And depending on the composition of the gases, it says something about how likely a volcano is to erupt. So they said every 15 years, a Reed senior should analyze the gases. So it was 36, 51, and I graduated in 66. So I was right there in time to analyze the gases. So I climbed the mountain and collected gases and analyzed them. And I actually predicted that and there's an equilibrium between sulfuric acid and sulfur. And based on that, I predicted that one of the Pacific Northwest volcanoes would erupt with devastating violence in the future. And St. Helens went off in 1980, and my chemistry professor was really impressed. I didn't tell him that near future in geologic time is probably a few million years. So it was kind of a lucky guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I... And then I went to Peru with my friends from Reed and collected volcanic gases from El Misti, a 20,000-foot volcano in Peru. And also, that was like my first expedition and my first time I'd left the United States.
Yeah.
So I continued doing climbing and chemistry. And when I was passing my junior I went to UC Berkeley to get a doctorate in chemistry, and I had passed my qualifying exams. And all my climbing partners were going to Denali on a guided expedition, and I decided maybe I could go too since I'd passed my qualifying exams. So I wrote for the application, and it said that women could go on the Denali expedition at a reduced price, but they could only go as far as base camp and help with the cooking.
Oh.
And so I called the guy who was leading it, and I said I had climbed higher than Denali in Peru, and I really wanted to climb. And he said, "Well, were you the only woman?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, did you do the hardest leading?" And I said, "Well, no, I didn't do the hardest leading, but I think I did my part." And he said, "I don't think women are emotionally stable enough or physically strong enough to climb high mountains. You know, you probably just got dragged up by the guys." So then I thought, well, as long as I'm always climbing with all guys, maybe, and me too. I mean, I wondered, am I really doing my share? So I thought, I wonder if a team of all women could climb Denali. And that was kind of a revolutionary idea, because even women climbers weren't sure they could, because in those days you had to bring 30 days of food, maybe you still do, but 30 days of food, all the gear was heavy. And everybody, it's about 200 pounds of gear that we had to carry up and down the mountain. And nobody had thought about pulling things on sleds in those days. So we would carry it all on your back, like in three loads of maybe 65, 70 pounds each. So it really was an adventure, you know, and we never knew if we'd be able to do any of it. And, you know, we felt a little bit like the grown-ups weren't there. Here we were, just women trying to climb Denali. And we did. We reached the summit.
Wow.
And our leader was a very strong Alaskan woman climber named Grace Homan. And Grace had done some really hard first ascents in Alaska, but they were like on the Kenai Peninsula, low peak, you know, 7,000, 8,000. And she had tried Denali twice and not succeeded. And she told me it was because of sexism, which I was inclined to believe. But it turned out there are people who can be really strong low down, but if they get up high, they are not strong, and they have altitude levels. And hers was about 14,000 feet. She was really strong to 14,000 feet, and then she wasn't strong at all. And so she was the leader. I was kind of the deputy leader, organizer. I was like 25 at the time. And so we're doing fine on the mountain, and then we get past 14,000 feet, and she can't carry a pack. She has migraines. She's very grumpy, you know, she was not a happy climber. But we got up to 17,000 with us carrying all her stuff, and that's the high camp. And then summit morning, she just looked terrible. And I said, you know, Grace, you should not go up the mountain. You should stay here, and maybe tomorrow you'll feel better and we can go with you again. But she insisted that she wanted to climb Denali, and she was, you know, sort of half collapsing, but she got herself to the top, and then pretty much got weaker and weaker, and just below the summit, she collapsed unconscious.
Oh, man.
And so that was when I became an expeditionary leader with an unconscious person, and there was, you could see a big storm coming in. So it was really a challenging time. Fortunately, we had a sleeping bag and a backpack and a rope, so we made a stretcher. And we hauled and lowered her along, you know, pulled her across the big plateau up there, and then hauled and lowered her down the ridge till we were just above Denali Pass, very steep slope, and we just couldn't go any further, and it was getting dark, brief dark then, but it was getting dark. And so two of us stayed with her, and she was still unconscious, and the storm was looking closer, and I still remember it was really cold, and I had what were called bunny boots then, which are these rubber boots, and your feet get soaking wet. And so I'm bivouacked there, wiggling my toes, thinking, oh my God, what do we do if the storm comes in? Like, do we stay with Grace and die, or do we leave her to die? You know, it was like bad, bad choices. Fortunately, the storm held off, and there was a men's expedition camped at Denali Pass, and their leader, who's still my friend, he's still on our mailing list, Mike Bialis, came back up, and with his help, Grace was a little conscious. We helped her get her crampons on. I still have really cold hands whenever I ski, because I kind of froze my fingers, flipping off my gloves to help get her crampons on her. And we got her down to Denali Pass, and then we got her down below Denali Pass, and then we got down to, I think, about 16,000 feet, maybe 14,000
14, probably, yeah.
It was 14. Yeah, it was 14. And then the storm came in. And then we had several days of every few hours clearing off the tent. But for me, it was a real transformation, because I had had a very tough childhood with lots of negative messages and didn't have much self-confidence. And I still remember, you know, sitting in my tent there thinking, wow, we got Grace down alive. We're pretty well. And so that was like where I sort of became a leader on Denali.
But leader by fire, it sounds like.
Yeah. So I begin my memoir, Breaking Trail, with that story because that was so important for me.
And that, what year was that again?
1970. Yeah, there was going to be a 50th anniversary. The Park Service had planned to fly us into the mountain and have a whole celebration, but that was 2020, so it didn't happen. So, and then I guess the next big change was a couple years later, formulated part of my career. I was in graduate school, just finishing my doctorate in chemistry, and I'd spent several weeks purifying the last sample of transfer RNA that I needed to analyze to get my doctorate, and I dropped it.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And it broke, and I was like, oh, no. So what could I do? I went to the movies, and at the movies, they were the North Side Theater in Berkeley was playing The Endless Summer, which was the Beach Boys going around the world looking for a perfect wave. And I remember still the moment of seeing them. They found the perfect wave off South Africa. But I remembered thinking, I'm a mountain climber. I should go around the world looking for a perfect mountain. And I went back to the chemistry lab. And that night, I made a plan that I'd have a season in the Alps, a season in Africa, a season in Asia, go scuba diving on the Great Barrier Reef, have a season in New Zealand. And then I'd come back and be a dull chemist for the rest of my life. So I told my PhD advisor about my plan, and he was not impressed. He did not think it would be good for my scientific career. It was a year and a half of climbing after I got my doctorate. And I did have a postdoc arranged, but I postponed my postdoc a year and a half. And so I was studying a molecule called transfer RNA, and so his daughter made me a flag that said transfer RNA, and then I flew it on all the summits I climbed, and that helped me. Remember, so, and we actually did what I had dreamed up. We climbed the highest peaks in Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, Iran, Mount Damavand, Afghanistan. We climbed 24,000 feet. We did hard ascents all around the world. And I had, again, organized it all, so I got my organizing ability and a lot more. We did first ascents in Kashmir of four peaks that had never been climbed before, over 20,000 feet. So, I mean, a big goal of my life is I've always sort of had pictures of how the world should be and then made them a reality. So that wrapped called it my endless...
Endless winter.
Endless winter, exactly. So that, again, was a case of dreaming something up and making it happen.
And what an amazing time to go to those places.
I felt so lucky.
Very lucky. What, you know, do you have advice for young women mountaineers?
Well, for any young mountaineers, I really recommend, you know, the tendency for people to want to do something hard and big name and go with a guide and say, you know, I've climbed this or that, but then they don't really develop mountain skills and mountain judgment, and if something happens to their guide, they're in trouble. So I always recommend find someone of your own ability and just do easy things together and learn how to read the weather, to look for avalanches, to find your way, develop your skills. Don't, you know, everybody wants to climb. Like in Colorado, everyone wanted to climb 14ers. And the 14ers would be overrun with people, but the 13ers, which were more interesting often, would be empty. You know, so just do modest climbs where you're taking responsibility, you're developing your skills. Take a good climbing class, but then then meet someone in your climbing class and develop your skills together, rather than climbing the biggest, highest thing with a guide and saying how much you've accomplished.
This is Paul Tordock. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm here with Arlen Plume, a chemist and mountaineer, and Pam Miller with the Alaska Community Action on Toxins. Let's see, Arlen, let's contend a little bit. So, Annapurna. Did I have that right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, in 1976, I had the opportunity to attempt Mount Everest. I was the first American woman.
Yep.
And I reached about 24,000 feet, but and our team was successful. And I realized it was time to give women a chance to climb 8,000 meter peaks. And after our experience on Denali and, you know, getting someone unconscious down from the summit, I knew that women could really do hard things. And so on our way back from Everest, I applied for a permit for Annapurna 1. And Annapurna 1 is the 10th highest mountain in the world, so not the highest. And I thought maybe it would be relatively easy. It was the first of the high 8,000 meter peaks ever climbed. Maurice Herzog, a French climber, climbed it in 1950. And I thought, first one climbed, not so high. maybe it'll be the easiest and safest. So maybe you know, but it turns out to be the most difficult and hardest, which we did not know at the time, and most dangerous. So then I, you know, invited, we had 10 women climbers from mostly the U.S., and it was really hard. We raised $80,000 to pay for it, selling T-shirts that say wow. Women's Places on top.
That's a lot of T-shirts, especially back then. Yeah,
yeah, we had a crazy T-shirt business based in my house to raise the money. But we did raise the money. We organized a film crew that made a documentary. We successfully climbed the mountain in spite of storms and avalanches and really tough conditions. We lost our second summit team, fell to their deaths, which was devastating for all of us. Everybody on the team was really depressed and had a really rough time afterwards because of losing our two friends. I wrote a book, Annapurna, Woman's Place, and we still all get together for reunions. We had kept trying during the pandemic, but now finally I think we'll have a reunion.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Amazing, an amazing read also, an excellent read. And so along the way, you're also a scientist, and you're a chemist. So tell us about that and what you're working on. And
and I think it really leads to the great work that ACAT is and Pam are doing. So I think the problem, and people don't recognize it, is there's tens of thousands of industrial chemicals, and many are used in products, and there's very little requirement for safety testing. And people kind of think if something's in an everyday product, it's going to be safe. But that's actually not true. Food, drugs, and pesticides, things that we put in our mouths, are regulated, maybe not as well as we'd like, but there's reasonable amounts of regulation. And other chemicals really aren't. And sadly enough, the greatest burden of the most harmful chemicals are chemicals that tend to head north and south to the polar regions on the winds and the waves. And they go up and they go down, and then they come near the poles and they just stay. So the polar regions, people who live all around the poles, like the native people here in Alaska, have very high rates of illnesses that can be related to harmful chemicals. In fact, the connection isn't for sure, but it appears to be related to chemicals. But birth defects in Alaska are twice as high as in the lower 48, and Native Alaskans have twice as high birth defect rates as others. And there are similar things in northern Scandinavia. You know, way north, the people in the north generally have a lot more health problems from chemicals, and there's lots more unfortunate chemicals that end up. Also, the chemicals build up the food chain, so they bioaccumulate, and like marine mammals will have really high levels, and native people in the far north usually eat marine mammals, so they get really high exposures. So that's why I'm such an admirer of Pam's work with ACAT, who really helps. It's a great environmental injustice, you know, that people who aren't using these chemicals can get the burden of the health problems from them. And that is what ACAT does, is try to remedy that environmental injustice.
Well, we'll come back to ACAT. So I guess, Arlene, what I'm curious about is how was there a connection between mountaineering and these chemicals and their interest? What got you interested in these chemicals?
Well, okay, so that story goes back to the 70s. I was climbing a high peak in India with America's leading young rock climber, who was a great environmentalist. And in those days, peaks, India would not let you have maps, and you didn't quite know where you were. And it turns out the peak we climbed had a big cornice over the top, and below that cornice was a vertical face going 5,000 feet down. So a cornice is where snow is just over air. And he unroped and went to see if that cornice summit was higher, and he fell to his death. Mm-hmm. And he was like 24 and had pioneered the hardest routes in Yosemite without using pitons. Anyway, so I was very depressed, and in his memory, I wanted to do something for the environment. And I learned that kids' pajamas in the United States were 10% by weight a toxic flame retardant called brominated tris, and it went into the child. Remember, things that you eat are regulated, but flame retardants can go into your body, and they weren't regulated at all, and we discovered the chemical went into children and that it was cancer-causing. And so I started working on a paper to tell the parents of America about the toxic flame retardant in their kids' pajamas. And then I got invited to Mount Everest on that expedition. Oh, yeah. And I sort of like, do I go to Mount Everest? Do I write the paper on the toxic pajamas? So I sort of did both. I went to Mount Everest, but every night I'd write the paper. And I finished it at about 24,000 feet. And then it went down to base camp, was carried by mail runner to Kathmandu, and was published in Science, which is a very well-read journal, just a few months after our expedition reached the summit of Everest. And in it, the subtitle said, you know, the main flame retardant in children's pajamas is a mutagen, changes DNA, and should not be used.
Wow.
And so that's most scientific papers, you know, end saying more study is needed, which is a safe recommendation. So that was pretty revolutionary, and that is indeed what we do at our institute, is we make strong recommendations based on science. But in any case, we made that recommendation, and then 3 months, and, you know, and we were on all the in those days, you know, you're on the three TV networks and everybody in America saw you, you know, so the media was pretty focused. So, you know, we wrote the paper and almost immediately thereafter it was published. Every parent in America knew about this and everybody was outraged. And 3 months after our paper came out, the Consumer Product Safety Commission banned pajamas with brominated tris.
Wow.
And
that seems unheard of.
3 months, right. Yeah. And so we thought the problem was solved. And I actually remember riding my bicycle down to Penny's. They had Penny's in those days, and buying about 30 pairs of pajamas in all different sizes to test to see if there still was tris. And the lady beamed at me and said, "Oh dear, you must have such a nice large family." And I felt like a super spy. And then I took little samples from the seams of the pajamas because I thought these are all perfectly good pajamas. I can give them to friends who have kids. And I measured using NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, what was in them. And about, you know, a third of them still had the old tris that hadn't gotten rid of it. But the rest had a new tris, chlorinated tris, which was similar in structure, function, and toxicity. So then we did more studies, showed that the chlorinated tris went into children, and it was also banned. That was in the 70s. And I will say that led directly to my current career. Because then after that, in 1980, Reagan became president. I was going to be, if Carter had been elected, I was going to be his toxic chemical advisor in D.C. But Reagan, you know, took the solar panels off the White House. These great EPA scientists studying chemicals were told they had to do regulatory work. People lost their grants. So there was just like all the work I was doing was completely not being done. So I thought, I've always dreamed of walking across the Himalayas, which is about a year-long walk, like from Chicago, no, like from San Francisco to New York, except
up and down.
Yeah, we averaged about 1,000 meters a day up and down. That's about 3,300 feet, so
wow.
It was very hilly. So I thought, well, this is a good time to take off and walk across the Himalayas. And anyway, so I had many adventures, fell in love, had my daughter. And so suddenly it was 2006.
Wow.
And it had been 26 years since I had done science, and my daughter was starting college. And I'd been writing a memoir for about 20 years. My memoir, Breaking Trail, was a big personal therapy project about my childhood and lots of stuff I learned. So it was 2006, and I wanted to go back to science. But I thought, I haven't done science for 26 years. Maybe I can wash test tubes in a lab, like, you know, so I went to a green chemistry meeting just seeing if there was something I could do that was useful. And there was one industry guy there who was the head of the Polyurethane Foam Association. And I sort of always go talk to industry people because they often can be helpful. And so he said, "What do you do?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't really do anything, but I did study flame retardants 26 years ago." And he said, "Flame retardants, we're really interested in them because we have to put them in our foam to meet this California flammability standard. And we had these great flame retardants called PBDEs, but they told us they were too dangerous. And so now we're using chlorinated tris. Do you have any thoughts about chlorinated tris? And I said, are you kidding? I said, that's the chemical we got out of kids' pajamas because it's cancer-causing. And he said, no, that can't be true. It's not the same chemical. But we compared the chemical structures, and it was. Huh. And so there I was, after 26 years of not doing science, knowing something useful that nobody but me sort of knew, that the new flame retardant was cancer-causing. Nobody remembered back. And so I actually wrote an op-ed for the New York Times that got a lot of attention. And we have in California the Office of Environmental Health and Hazard Assessment that looks for carcinogens in everyday products. And I somehow got to do a talk for them, and they bumped tris up to the head of their list and showed that it was cancer-causing. That started my whole new career. And I thought I'd actually kind of wanted to walk across the Himalayas again, and was vaguely planning to. But I thought, well, I'll spend 3 months and solve this problem of the toxic flame retardants in the furniture. Exactly. Yeah. And we worked super hard for a year. We got legislation to change. With flame retardants, it's all about what's your flammability standard, and you need to change the standard. And we realized that you could change the standard where you could stop fires better without flame retardants by having a standard that stopped fires in fabric rather than letting the fire burn through to the foam, which is really flammable and is going to burn anyway. It doesn't really do much good, the old standard. So we thought, we'll have legislation and stop the use of these bad flame retardants. And we were almost successful, and then suddenly the chemical industry like spent more than $7 million in a week on this huge advertising campaign and probably paying lots of money to legislators. Anyway, basically, it was from 2006 till finally 2013, things changed. And that was, and the every time we had legislation, it was defeated. A reporter documented $23 million was spent defeating legislation. This was a California standard, but it was followed throughout all of the U.S. and Canada. So all the furniture in the U.S., Canada, Alaska, the foam was 10% by weight, sorry, 5% by weight, a toxic flame retardant like chlorinated tris or PBDEs that came out, ended up in people and the environment. So it was quite a struggle. And in fact, we were finally successful because I started hiking with our governor, Jerry Brown's senior advisor. And in those days, anybody who hiked with me got a big earful about the toxic flame retardants that are in every, you know, they're in the furniture and they don't cause a benefit, but they cause cancer and they're so harmful. And, you know, it used to be at a party if someone asked me what I did and I started telling them, they'd always say, I have to go now. And I'd see them talking to people on the other side of the room because I was such a bore. But anyway, Jerry Brown, senior advisor, started hiking with me and he got an earful. Yeah. And then he shared it all with the governor, and the governor decided that he would really use his authority to start changing the standard. And that's what happened.
That's quite the story. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordock. I'm here with Arlene Bloom and Pam Miller. We'll take a short break and be right back with more from Arlene and Pam.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm here with Arlene Bloom, scientist and mountaineer, and Pam Miller, executive director and senior research scientist of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, ACAT. So Arlene, we left before the break, you're talking about the flame retardants in California, and I think Jerry Brown was involved. You were out hiking with his senior policy person, and tell us that story a little bit, like how Jerry Brown came around and went from one end to the other.
Back in the 70s, there were a lot of fires, and people thought, let's put flame retardants in everything because that's going to help. And nobody really asked if the standards provided a fire safety benefit, and the answer is they often did not. And nobody asked if the flame retardants were harmful, and it turns out that most of them are extremely harmful. But nobody knew that back in the 70s. And so Jerry Brown signed into law a requirement that the foam in all the furniture and children's products sold in California would end up having to be 5% by weight a flame retardant. And it turned out that the standard was really not useful because the foam is inside and it would just stop a flame for a few seconds, but if the a small flame, but if the fabric was burning, it would hardly not stop the flame at all, and it would make the fire smokier and more toxic, and overall no benefit. And it's much better just to stop the fire in the fabric and have it not reach the foam. So we just realized that, and we realized how harmful the chemicals were, because I had worked on the same chemicals in the 70s in kids' pajamas. And so we proposed legislation, four different bills, to try to change to a flammability standard that would really stop fires without toxic chemicals. And they were always defeated by groups with names like Citizens for Fire Safety, who turned out to be the manufacturers of the flame retardants. And it was kind of an ugly story. I was working for free. It was me and my cat versus the chemical industry. And they spent a document of $21 million in Sacramento.
Wow.
It's really ugly. And this is not only, but this California standard, because California was the only place with a standard. It's a big market. Everybody made all North American furniture to meet the California standard. So that means not only Californians, but people in Alaska, people in Canada, had high levels of toxic flame retardants in their bodies. And a lot of human epidemiology studies show that pregnant women are most vulnerable, and if they have high levels in their body during critical windows of brain development, their children's brain development is impacted. They say the average American child's lost 3 to 5 IQ points from the flame retardants in the furniture. And that's serious, 3 to 5 IQ points. That means productivity loss of billions of dollars, because you realize you have fewer very smart people and more people who are in trouble at the other end of the IQ spectrum. So it's a serious problem, no fire safety benefit, and but people just didn't realize that, so it was quite it took a long time, but finally the standard was changed, and it's not just us. A lot of great groups like ACAT worked on that. I think ACAT had legislation to ban certain flame retardants, which all is very helpful. So it was an overall big effort from the NGO community. But Jerry Brown, who had signed the law in place, discovered how harmful his law was since I started hiking with his senior advisor. And then he instructed the bureau that was in charge to really work to change the standard. And also along the way, we worked with the trade associations who knew the flame retardant standard didn't work, but when they learned how harmful it was to workers and the public, we had support from the furniture industry, the foam industry, the fabric industry,
children's
products.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So all the industries. And in fact, we still meet maybe 3 or 4 times a year with all those industries, because the flame retardant producers are just so persistent, and they're still trying to put flame retardants back in lots of products where they're do not provide a fire safety benefit, but are quite harmful to our population.
Yeah, let's talk about ICCAT, Pam. This is Pam Miller, the executive director. Pam, tell us fill us in on what ICCAT does, its mission, a little bit of its history.
Sure. Well, thanks, Paul, and I'd just love to hear you talk all day, Arlene. I'm so happy you're here. ACAT, Alaska Community Action on Toxics, is an environmental health and justice research and advocacy organization. We conduct community-based research working primarily with indigenous peoples in rural Alaska, trying to understand exposures and ways to prevent them, whether from military contamination, oil and gas operations, or mining, or to address the long-range transport of chemicals into this region from long-range transport. Because when I founded ACAT in 1997, we were working locally on issues like trying to keep pesticides out of schools and site-specific contamination issues from military and industrial sources. But the science was just becoming very clear at the time that global transport of chemicals in a process known as global distillation was affecting the Arctic and the Antarctic because of the transport on wind and ocean currents in this region and the bioaccumulation, as Arlene talked about, in fish, wildlife, and people. And in fact, we learned that Arctic indigenous peoples have some of the highest levels of many of these persistent chemicals of any population on Earth. So we began to work on the negotiation of an international treaty, now known as the Stockholm Convention, which is aimed at eliminating the world's most dangerous chemicals.
Pam, explain a little bit more of how they end up in the Arctic. That would you call it the Arctic distillation? Is that right?
Yeah. Sure. So most of the industrial chemicals and pesticides are not produced and not used to a great extent in Alaska. But they do, they're volatile chemicals. So they rise into the atmosphere and through prevailing oceanic and atmospheric currents begin to move northward. And the Arctic is a hemispheric sink here for the deposition of these chemicals in a process known as either the grasshopper effect, because they rise up into the atmosphere. When they hit a colder air mass, they tend to settle out, but they keep migrating northward. It's also known as global distillation. And because many of these chemicals are bioaccumulative, they tend to concentrate in the fatty tissues of animals as well as people.
And we eat those animals.
Yes.
So that's where they end up. And also, so go ahead and talk a little bit about what AICAT is working on, legislation. What are you guys up to now?
Sure. We have a real environmental justice focus, and we believe everyone has the right to clean air, clean water, and toxics-free food. We have several community-based research projects that are funded by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, understanding more and working with tribes in places like St. Lawrence Island, also known as Sivilcoc, to look at the effects of endocrine-disrupting chemicals on people. So not only the levels of these contaminants in the environment and people, but how they affect health and what are some of the adverse health outcomes of exposures to these chemicals. So that's some of the research that we're doing. And then on the advocacy level, we're working now on a state bill, state legislation, that would ban the use of a harmful class of chemicals that Arlene mentioned, known as PFAS, or per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, also known as forever chemicals, because they virtually don't break down in the environment and they're very harmful to human health at extremely low exposure levels. So we're working on a bill that had a hearing today, Senate Bill 67, that was introduced by Senator Jesse Keel, and we're asking people to support this because it would stop the dispersive use of firefighting foams, which is the major source of contamination here in Alaska. We now know that there are about 469 sites around Alaska that have soil and or water contamination. Many communities from the North Slope of Alaska down to Southeast have these chemicals in their drinking water at unsafe levels. So this is a really critical public health issue that we're working on right now.
And as I recall, the federal government has come out with some potential regulations, is that correct? On PFAS.
Yes. Yep. Yes, this was a great step in the right direction. It would establish more health protective and enforceable drinking water standards, because this class of chemicals has been virtually unregulated either at a state or national or even international level. And we have been successful in banning some of these PFAS chemicals at the international level, but a lot more needs to be done. And we're calling on our state legislators because they have an obligation to us here in Alaska. Things take a lot longer at the federal level, but we can enact measures now that will protect people living here in Alaska.
Are these, the PFAS, the forever chemicals, they made the news, I believe, in some of the rural areas because of use around airports? Do I have that right?
Yeah. Yeah, so the major use here in Alaska, we don't have manufacturing of PFAS chemicals, so the major source of contamination of drinking and surface waters and fish and wildlife as well is the dispersive use of these PFAS-based firefighting foams that are used on military bases as well as airports.
Thanks. Listen, Outdoor Explorer is the name of the show, and we're on Alaska Public Media. Let's talk about the relationship with outdoors. Alaskans love their salmon. So should I be worried about the salmon I'm eating, or like talk a little bit about that without, you know, scaring me too much, maybe.
Well, truthfully, there's been very little testing of salmon or other fish in Alaska. With salmon, they are not as contaminated as other fish that are higher on the food web. Mm-hmm. So I would be concerned about larger fish, predatory fish like halibut and rockfish. Salmon spend a lot more time at sea, so they're more distant from some of the more concentrated sources of PFAS. But we've done testing, for example, on St. Lawrence Island, and we have found concerning levels of PFAS in fish as well as in people. And we found a correlation between the exposures to people on St. Lawrence Island with adverse health outcomes such as thyroid disease.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to establish cause and effect. I grew up next to a Superfund site as well, and my mother was a nurse. We believe that there was a cancer cluster in my family and neighborhood caused by this Superfund site that was a chemical manufacturing company that manufactured a class of chlorinated chemicals called medium and short chain chlorinated paraffins. So because my mom had a health background, she began documenting the health problems in our community. That's largely why I got involved in this too, but it did affect my family, and I think this is a very personal issue for many people. But it is very hard to establish cause and effect because many of the diseases associated with chemical exposures have a long lag time. So somebody might develop cancer, but it could be 20 or even 30 years after they're exposed in their childhood.
Right. Yeah.
When, you know, we're most vulnerable, really, as babies and as young children and adults. So I think the science is becoming a lot more clear about how chemicals can affect our health, particularly with regard to endocrine disrupting chemicals, multi-generational effects of chemicals, and understanding the effects of, you know, site-specific as well as exposures that can be caused by exposure to household products and chemicals in household products.
Let's talk. I don't know. Do you have?
I'll just add that when people study exposures to chemicals and say they're cancer causing, that's across the population. So you have a cancer causing chemical in your body and you have cancer, but you can't really prove that's the reason because we move around and we're exposed to lots of things. There are a few exceptions. For example, there's a rare and fatal kind of lung cancer called mesothelioma that's associated with asbestos exposure. And if you're an asbestos worker or the wife of an asbestos worker and you have mesothelioma, you can say that's asbestos. And interestingly enough, if you think back to that train derailment, just as soon as I heard about it and heard it was vinyl chloride in those cars, I actually proposed an op-ed to the New York Times that got published because people had not really thought about that. And vinyl chloride monomer is associated with a rare and fatal form of cancer called angiosarcoma of the liver, and it's only caused by vinyl chloride.
Oh, interesting.
And people didn't immediately recognize how harmful those chemicals are. And I will just say there's a wonderful book called Deceit and Denial that it made me think of because back, I mean, it's so typical of the chemical industry, but PVC, which is, you know, used for water piping and roofing.
Everything.
My roof has been leaking. You know, it's so much rain in California, my roof has been leaking. And the people who come to propose estimates, the best material is apparently PVC.
Oh, no.
I mean, there are no good materials for roofing.
Yeah.
That's really a problem. But in any case, it's made from vinyl chloride. And way back, maybe in the late 60s, the people who made vinyl chloride got word that mice exposed to the monomer, the vinyl chloride monomer, the mice were getting angiosarcoma of the liver, and they really worried, but then they ultimately just marketed more better living through chemistry. And then it turned out the rats who were exposed got angiosarcoma of the liver, and they again ignored it, and then the workers who were exposed got angiosarcoma of the liver. So that story is in deceit and denial. And then ultimately the EPA told them they had to clean it up, and they were like, you know, it'll cost too much, we can't do it, but they did clean it up. So workers are not exposed. You know, I think they have ways of making it, but on the other hand, things happen, like this train derailment. You know, when you're moving vinyl chloride monomer, it's a really dangerous thing, and you know, there should be huge precautions if you're doing that, but there don't seem to be many, but maybe more are happening. So anyway, that just comes to mind when you're talking about how you can't relate on a one-to-one basis, but over the population you can.
This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Arlen, one of the stories you told the other night that I heard was talking about outdoor gear, that we like our Gore-Tex and our many synthetic materials and everything. But I think one of the interesting things I recall you saying is that it's also about the transportation. It's not about the material itself, but elaborate on that a little bit. Like how do we address that? How do we, as an outdoor person, wrap our head around that?
Well, the very good news is that California passed legislation last October banning, starting in 2024, the use of any PFAS, which is the problematic chemical, the forever chemical, banning the use in all textiles, and that includes outdoor gear. And I have personally, since 2013, only 10 years, been trying to persuade the outdoor industry to talk to me about stopping the use, but they did not talk to me until the law passed. Huh. And now the outdoor industry has to stop using it, and they are. They're rising to the occasion, and they're trying to beat the 2024 deadline. We held a meeting for a lot of major outdoor manufacturers in November. I had been trying to have the meeting for 10 years, but when the legislation passed, they were willing to have the meeting. So I think future Gore-Tex will not have PFAS in it. But at the moment, stuff in the stores, probably most of it still does, because it takes a while to change the supply chain. And I like to say that probably your Gore-Tex jacket isn't going to hurt you. The main problem is the manufacturing. Yeah. So I think if you have a jacket, you probably don't want to throw it away, but you don't want to buy any more. So you want to avoid buying things that have these chemicals. And I will put in a word that we have a series, like a 4-minute videos about classes of harmful chemicals. There are 6 that we focus on that have a big chunk of the harmful chemicals in everyday products, not all of them, but quite a lot. And if people go to a website, it's just 6classes.org, they can watch a 4-minute video on PFAS and learn why it's harmful, where it's used, and things they can do to reduce exposure. So, and if they have half an hour, they can watch all 6 classes videos and an introduction and learn how to move to healthier products. So that's my little pitch for learning more.
Another thing that caught my attention tonight was that, because one of the Superfund sites on this lake that I mentioned was a leather factory, and you told the story about Keen, the shoe company Keen. I thought that was a really positive story. Do you want to relate that?
Yeah. So Keen, who make water shoes, decided that they would want to get all the 6 classes out of their shoes. And when it came to PFAS, they looked and they found 100 places where there were PFAS. And they said, we're water shoes. We don't need PFAS. And so they looked again, and 70 of the places, like 2/3, there was no need. But then there were about 30 places where they really did need it.
Yeah.
And then it took them a number of years and quite a lot of money to research and find alternatives. And they have a Keen green page they put together with information for other shoe companies and outdoor companies on how to do it more quickly, not to take years, to help them move away from PFAS. And I think that's quite useful to the rest of the outdoor industry that now has to do it because of regulation. But Keen actually was ahead of the curve and did it based on good values. And we have worked with a number of companies like that. IKEA, in 2015, at one of our retreats, learned about the harm of PFAS, and within a year, they had removed it from their shower curtains, umbrellas, a number of you know, products where the water repellency was the desired property. But it turns out that there aren't great substitutes for grease repellency, and so they had tablecloths that were treated with PFAS, and they couldn't find a good replacement, so IKEA just stopped making tablecloths.
Uh-huh.
And now they only make tablecloths that are not stain repellent.
Yeah.
So in other words, they let their values lead over profit, which is nice to see when companies do that.
I'm interested in this sort of, from both of you, this science and advocacy, this sort of, because you're both in the outdoors, but maybe I'll talk a little bit about that, how can science or Pam be most effective in advocating for really anything? It seems like we're losing that a little bit in the dialogue in our country.
Yes, and from the very beginning when ACOUT was founded, we were firmly committed to understanding and conducting community-based research and science and publishing that. And in my career as a biologist, I realized that science is important, science is critical to do good science, but science is not enough. And to help, my real dream was then to use science and interpret science and to help make sure that good science informs policy. So we've done that really at a local, national, statewide, international level to have our community-based research, the research that we do here in Alaska and in the Arctic, to inform decision makers in the state legislature, in Congress, and at the international level at the Stockholm Convention. And we bring indigenous peoples who've been involved in this research to the table at all of those levels to make sure that not only the science, but the traditional knowledge that contributes to that science, that is science, informs decision makers and make sure that the decision makers realize that it's not just an abstract issue, that these are issues that affect public health, that affect people's children, their families, their own families. And so just to make sure it's not an abstract issue published in an obscure journal somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Arlen, do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, very similar to Pam. Our institute is pretty much all, I think everybody has a PhD or a master's.
And this is the Green Science Policy Institute.
Right, correct? The Green Science Policy Institute is composed of scientists, all of us. And we do science with the idea of changing policy. We don't actually do the science ourselves, but we collaborate with some of the world's best scientists. So we, for example, 10 years ago when I realized the harm from PFAS, the only other people who realized it were scientists. And I asked PFAS scientists from all over the world, would they like to have a call once a month to talk about what we can do about the harm of PFAS? And I was amazed everybody said yes, because all these scientists were really worried. And so we've actually had a call the first Wednesday of the month, every month since 2013. This is our 10th anniversary. And during those calls, we get good ideas for research.
Yep.
And carry them out, and then we write papers, and I think the average scientific papers just have a few hundred or a few thousand readers, and ours tend to have tens of thousands of readers because they're things that are really important to people, and we really focus on communicating, and then we use the papers as the basis for legislation. So for example, we did a paper looking at cosmetics and discovered half the cosmetics had PFAS, particularly things like waterproof mascara, shiny lip gloss, shiny foundation, waterproofing shine. But the day our paper went online, we were able to have bipartisan legislation in both the Senate and the House in Washington, D.C., called the No PFAS in Cosmetics Acts. And so the paper provided the impetus. And then we had a press conference where one of our partners, breast cancer prevention partners, who'd been working with cosmetics companies, invited their whole list, and I think people from about 40 cosmetics companies were in the audience, and they heard, you know, like Senator Blumenthal telling them how they had to get the PFAS out of their cosmetics. And the bills didn't pass, but the companies heard the message, and they started moving it out. And then this October, no PFAS in cosmetics bill did pass in California. And since California is a big market, I think our paper started something that is now leading to getting PFAS out of cosmetics. So that's an example where the paper plus the policy plus some advocacy can really change things.
And were they in sunscreen? I know sunscreen was in the news.
Not
about
PFAS, but other worrisome things.
There were some,
things.
And they sort of removed those out of those also.
Yeah, I think the problem with sunscreens is they really harm coral reefs.
Right.
And they just devastate them, and it's really important for people to use kinds of sunscreens that do not harm the reefs if they're going to be snorkeling in beautiful and tropical places.
And also think about the Teflon pans. Like, they're pretty ubiquitous in outdoor equipment.
Yeah, the problem with Teflon is mostly the manufacturing.
Okay.
It's like a big molecule called a polymer, and if the Teflon's heated too hot, it is a problem. There's something called parakeet fever, where if you shouldn't keep your parakeet in the same room as your Teflon pan, because if you heat Teflon too hot, it can kill birds, and workers have gotten it. It's not good for you. But if you treat your Teflon pan kindly, it probably won't cause a problem. But people have seen, there's a wonderful movie called Dark Waters.
And
this is about a Teflon factory contaminating West Virginia and Ohio, and an amazing lawyer, Rob Bellotte, who just incredible persistence was able to track down the cause and learn about the health effects and really make a change.
Well, we're about wrapping up. Arlene and Pam, thank you for joining us. I guess lastly, Arlene, for you, what keeps the fire in your belly? What keeps you motivated? You went skiing today, but you're still out doing this.
What an opportunity. Remember, I took 26 years off.
Yeah.
And to come back and be able to do work, you know, like every house in North America, we have contributed to the fact that the furniture, for those who can afford new furniture, the furniture does not contain flame retardants that are going to hurt kids' brains and bodies. And the carpets aren't going to have PFAS. So it's the opportunity to make the world better. And I think both ACAT and the Green Science Policy Institute, we feel so blessed and fortunate to have the opportunity to do work that makes every home healthier and the environment and wildlife and everything. So what an opportunity.
Yeah. Well, thank you for both of your work. This has been Outdoor Explorer. I've been with Arlene Bloom, Mountaineer, and with the Green Science Policy Institute. And Pam Miller, the Executive Director of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Thank you both for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to my guests, Arlene Bloom, whose new book is titled Breaking Trail, and Pam Miller with Alaska Community Action on Toxics. And a big thanks to our producer, Airport. This is your host, Paul Torduck, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, climb on, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.